All right. My name's Emma with the Wisconsin UW-Madison Oral History Department. On behalf of the MOSU program in history, here with Eunice Gibson, if you want to just say your name and spell it for me.
My name's Eunice Gibson, E-U-N-I-C-E, Gibson, G-I-B-S-O-N.
All right. So this is just going to be a quick conversation that we're going to have about her time at UW. Can you just give me a little bit background of like where you grew up and your upbringing?
Sure. I was born in a farmhouse in Kansas, the same farmhouse where my dad was born in the Depression in 1934. My mom always said that the Depression came to the farm 10 years before it came to the rest of the country. So, and then we lived in another farmhouse, but then with the beginning of World War II, my father decided that he didn't want to continue farming, and so he, right after Pearl Harbor 2, he went to Omaha for a class in welding, and after it was 10 weeks, he and a neighbor were sent to Wisconsin to look for jobs in the shipyards, mm-hmm. and which were then booming, or just starting to boom. Mm-hmm. And so he got a job in the shipyard in Sturgeon Bay, and very exciting then. My grandpa and my uncle helped us sell all the farm stuff. And in the middle of the night, we drove up to Lincoln, Nebraska, and got on the Rock Island Rocket and for Chicago and then Green Bay. Mm-hmm. I remember the train being really crowded, lots of people in uniform. So our dad picked us up in Green Bay. That was exciting. But the only place he could find for us to live in Sturgeon Bay was a tourist cabin. And my mom was pregnant, and of course there was no phone. Mm. So this was way more of a challenge for her than I knew about, because I was just about 8 years old at that time. And I had my brother. So we only lived in that tourist cabin a week, and then my dad found some cherry picker cabins because it was late May, early June. Mm-hmm. Cherry picking hadn't started. So we lived in a couple weeks in those cherry cabins, and then he found a place out in the country. Farmers have big houses, and there were like 12,000 shipyard workers in Sturgeon Bay, which was just a mm-hmm. sleepy resort town, and so people were living everywhere. So we went to, besides the cherry pickers cabins, this house, and then more cherry pickers cabins, and another house in the country. Finally, what we call the government houses. The government had thrown up some houses, which, by the way, in Sturgeon Bay, we can still visit that house. And that's our first indoor plumbing, mm-hmm. our first electricity.
What year was this?
It's going to be like 43, 44, like
okay.
that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, and so the gift of that was I learned not to be so attached to where I lived. Mm-hmm. You feel sorry for people who've, like if you read the book Janesville, where the GM plant closes and people think, okay, if I'm going to get a job, I'll have to move, and I can't. But that never bothers me. Seen one house, you've seen them all.
Sure.
So, but then when the war was over, the shipyard pretty much closed down. So then my dad found a job in Oshkosh. And I had made a friend in Sturgeon Bay who was a baton twirler. Mm. And I was really attracted to that. And she gave me an old wooden baton, and my mom allowed me to take lessons mm-hmm. from Vesper Chamberlain, who was the baton and dancing teacher in the Fox River Valley, 50 cents a lesson once a week.
Is this the 40s still or the 50s?
Still 40s.
Still the 40s?
Yeah. And so, and I even performed in her recital. I think my grandma made me a uniform out of red satin. So when we moved to Oshkosh, I was ready to go forward with mm-hmm. baton twirling. I spent a year in the Lutheran school. There hadn't been a Lutheran school in Sturgeon Bay, but my family's very Lutheran. And so in Oshkosh, after the Lutheran school, I went to the ninth grade in a different school, and finally, 3 years in the same school, Oshkosh High School. So I graduate in 51, I was the drum majorette.
Mm-hmm.
That was exciting. That was, there wasn't much a girl could do to stand out,
mm-hmm.
and for some reason, I love to stand out.
Mm-hmm. I feel
but
that.
Another thing, it was so easy to get into the university in those days.
Madison?
Yeah.
Okay.
I look back and I think, well, first of all, my folks still coming from the farm.
Mm-hmm.
My mom had been a teacher, so she'd been to high school, but my dad had not. And they were certainly literate. They wrote letters. My mom was very well read in her high school. She would always quote either from Shakespeare or from the Bible. But they had no notion of college and what that was about.
Mm-hmm.
There was a teacher's college in Oshkosh, and everyone assumed I would go to that. But my high school principal, I have to give him so much credit, J. Harwood Evans was his name, he found a Minnie Detling scholarship for me, which was a good scholarship. I think it was $500 a semester, it might have been.
Mm-hmm.
That's extremely munificent for that time. And I do remember my mom and dad and I meeting with him and him describing how it would work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I think, the vice principal who said to me, you know, with the Korean War and everything going on, you never know that your husband will be able to support you.
Right.
So it's really a good thing for you to go to college and get a degree, so
mm-hmm.
because you might have to support yourself. I've never forgotten that.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. So what year did you come to Madison?
It was the fall of 51.
51?
Yeah. And again, I want to stress it was so easy. I think, you know, I filled out a form in Oshkosh,
mm-hmm.
sent it down. My principal recommended me, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that got past high school could get into UW-Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, registration was simple. You weren't allowed to just live on your own. A girl had to be in an approved rooming house or a dorm, and we couldn't afford a dorm, but they helped us find a rooming house.
Mm-hmm.
It was on Chandler Street,
mm-hmm.
Easy walking distance of the campus. And I think what kids go through today to get into the university and how much it costs and what they have to do, it's just, I don't know how they do it. It was so easy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm out of state. I'm an out-of-state student, so that's even more...
Unbelievable.
More money than it would be if I was from Wisconsin or even Minnesota.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So what are your... you just talked about some of your earliest memories of Madison and the campus.
Walking.
Yeah.
Walking. Although I learned to take the bus. At first, I got a job at the Kale School of Dance teaching baton twirling. And then I also had a job at the East Side Businessmen's Club. They also had things for kids to do, and I taught baton twirling there. But then a friend of mine found me a nanny job. So I kept the East Side Businessmen teaching, but I had to drop the Kale
mm-hmm.
teaching because I had to live in Sherwood. This was live-in. And it was... it was isolating, but it was a good fortune for me because I spent then very, very little and was able to focus a lot of time on studying
mm-hmm.
because I couldn't go places in the evening, which would a normal campus life would do. So I was, when those 2 years were over, I was kind of glad to move to campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately turned into all the outside activities I could possibly think of.
Like what?
Daily Cardinal, that was big, and theater, because mm-hmm. that was something I was really interested in. Mm-hmm. And I would spend most evenings backstage working on painting sets. I often did costumes because I loved to sew, and mm-hmm. there was a real nice costume lady, and we got to be good friends. I got paid for sewing costumes for the Hare's Foot Club. Mm. The Hare's Foot Club, you know, mm-hmm. the men who dress up in skirts. And so I made the skirts, and I actually got paid by the hour for that. That was a thrill. Mm-hmm. That's how I met my husband. I was dancing in the chorus of Bittersweet, and there was this really skinny guy that was pulling the curtain. In those days, there wasn't an electronic curtain. It was somebody pulling a rope. Mm. And he was so skinny that he flew up.
Oh, no.
So anyway, we started dating, and that was the future.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Just like that?
Yep, just like that.
Wow. So what was Madison like at that time?
Well, State Street was a busy street with cars.
Yeah.
It's
it had cars.
Oh, yeah. You drove up and down State Street. You parked on State Street. You went Christmas shopping on the square. I can remember doing that after I was married. I think before I was married, I probably didn't do much Christmas shopping. But I took the bus. When I lived in Sherwood, I had to take the bus every morning. I still like to take the bus. Mm-hmm. But the
pretty handy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The shopping was completely different. If there was a mall, I didn't know about it. I don't think there was. Mm-hmm. You could shop. You could buy dresses. There were probably 4 shoe stores on the square.
Oh, wow.
Now
it's just restaurants.
Exactly. Exactly. But then, of course, in later years, I worked for Paul Soglin, so I was able to see how he worked for that change. I mean, he's the one that got the urban transit money to close off State Street and rework that.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting to see that.
Yeah. So in Madison at that time, what were some of the, influences from the, like, from the time and in from that period? Because you mentioned the Korean War. Was that...
Yes, and I did, other than that, I didn't think about it very much. I just was focused on studies.
Yeah.
I will say I was kind of a back and forth student. I had the notion of being a dance major. I'm sure, looking back, I can't imagine why. But I just thought it would be fun, it would be different, and so that's what I did. But lucky for me, the dance majors were all put into integrated liberal studies.
Oh, okay.
And that was a 2-year program
mm-hmm.
where you, the two teachers that I remember the most were Professor Walter Agard and Professor Paul McKendrick. They're the ones that taught the classics part of ILS. Mm-hmm. And that was just a whole new world for me.
Mm-hmm.
That was really exciting. The 2-year program really brought you into the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, Herbert Howe was just a grad student, I think, at that time, or working under Agard and McKendrick. He rode a bike. Now, people did not ride bikes in those days.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see it. Later on, when my husband was in law school, Professor William Gorham Rice also rode a bike. But that was a standout thing. You didn't.
Now it's every day.
Now it's
everybody.
Everyone
rides a
right.
bike.
That's right. I don't know why people didn't then. It makes sense, but they didn't.
Yeah. So, you said your major was dance, right?
But then I changed to regular physical education.
Okay.
And again, I look back and I think by the decisions that I made. I loved the classes. I loved the golf. I loved the tennis. I loved the fencing. That was great.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the sports. Doing that was something I'd always enjoyed. But then to do the teaching for PE, you had to wear the most horrendous outfit. I made myself the jacket, which was just a blazer. But then you had to wear pleated shorts that went down to your knees. And I thought, no, I'm not going around like that. So then I changed my major to German.
Okay.
But I had, of course, I had taken German in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I had to, I spent a little more time. I may have had 190 credits when I graduated. I don't think they let you do this today, but they did.
I think it's standard as 120 now.
Right. I took a heavy credit load, and I audited because I had friends who were in journalism, because I worked at the Cardinal.
Mm-hmm.
They recommended, now I'm going to forget the professor's name, it was a poli-sci course in constitutional law.
Mm-hmm.
David, it will come to me. Names come later.
Sure.
But I audited that. I didn't take the exam, but it opened my eyes a little bit to politics and the outside world. And so then I did graduate, but by that time I was pregnant. I got another scholarship for a semester of grad school in German, but then when the baby came, I knew I had to get busy and get a job so my husband could go to law school, which I did do.
Well, now what year was this?
It would be, she was born in 56.
Okay.
So
you graduated undergrad in 55?
Actually, in those days, it was February of 56.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then your German MA was that
this, well,
right
I didn't
after?
I didn't achieve that.
Okay.
I had to leave that behind.
Okay.
It was interesting though. Mm-hmm. I wish that I remembered more German than I do. Although one funny thing about the aging brain, the vocabulary is coming back to me.
Oh.
I don't know why it is, but
weird.
I'm struggling with Spanish, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So what came next, I got a teaching job, and then I got another teaching job. I taught, but then, and this isn't here in Dane County,
mm-hmm.
the Dane County school districts lived on students' wives. So they never had to go up in the salary schedule, because when the husband graduated, the wife would leave.
Mm.
And so then they would have another new student wife. So that kept their education budget as low as possible. So
a lot of turnover?
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
And I took part in that. But then I got pregnant again, and I was treated very generously by the school district. They said, well, we're going to offer you your contract, but you know, since you're pregnant, you aren't going to want to accept it. So I had to look for a different job, which... Again, good fortune. I had been volunteering at the state office for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
so I was able to get a job there.
Wow. And was this 58?
More or less.
Around that time, 60
yeah.
maybe?
Yeah. I started as the bookkeeper. They call it the finance secretary, and it was on the letterhead, but it just was a bookkeeper, which I, of course, knew nothing about. But...
No, I mean, you did dance at PE, and here you are bookkeeping for the Democratic
right.
Party.
The person who was doing it and left showed me how to do it, and also my fellow teacher who taught business classes had a textbook on bookkeeping, so she lent me that.
Oh, okay.
So, you know.
You can make it by.
That's right. And there
it's
was no computer
curve.
Or anything. You just keep a journal. So that was easy to do. And then when the executive secretary departed, I got that job.
Mm.
For that job, I had to learn shorthand. Now, that is so funny. I gave a talk for the 50th anniversary of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. The state bar urged lawyers to go out to schools and give lectures about Brown mm-hmm. and what that had meant and what that was about. So I talked to the eighth graders at Van Nuys Middle School about Brown and what led up to that, and one of the students says, who are you? And then I tell them what I've done. I've taught shorthand in Panama. And she says, shorthand? What's that? So I demonstrated, and all they were so excited, shorthand, they do my name in shorthand. That was fun. Mm-hmm. But it's a good way of how things change so fast. Mm-hmm.
So how has Madison changed since you came here to now?
Oh, well, Okay, back to my job as executive secretary in the Democratic Party.
Yes.
One day the phone rings, I pick up the phone, and it's the city clerk. Name, of course, I can't remember. And I say, how can I help you? And he says, how can I keep the students from voting? And I, well, I hadn't thought about that. But I'm not sure how I even handled that question, because obviously if you're employed by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, you want the students to vote.
You want the students to vote, yeah.
Right, so I'm not quite sure how I got through that. But it was, working in politics was of course a completely new, and it was a way of meeting interesting people.
Yeah.
I would take the, every month the Democratic State Administrative Committee would meet in different parts of the state, and I'd take the minutes. I worked under Pat Lucey, mm-hmm. who later became the governor, but I think we were moving. We lived elsewhere at that time, but a man that I admire tremendously. Mm-hmm. I always say I've worked for two of the smartest people in the world. One is Pat Lucey, and the other is Paul Sovran.
Mm-hmm.
So my husband graduates law school.
What year?
61.
61, okay.
And so we had been through the Kennedy campaign,
right,
which was
right.
very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stories there. But then my husband sought a job in Washington and was able to get a job with the Federal Trade Commission, which is an interest that he had always had in antitrust. And I was able to get a job in Senator Harrison Williams' office.
Hmm.
So now we're living in
D.C.
D.C.
How many kids did you have at that point?
Three. Three girls.
Okay.
The youngest one was born just before we moved to Washington. She was very little when we moved to Washington. We just celebrated her 57th birthday. So I worked for Williams, and he was the chief sponsor of the Urban Mass Transportation bill, which started, you know, what the federal government does today in urban mass transportation, which made State Street possible.
Mm-hmm.
But then we had made a political friend, Jim Magellis, who was defeated in his run for Congress. But President Kennedy appointed him United States Agency for International Development Mission Director in Yemen.
Okay.
And he did well in Yemen. He would come back and visit, and we'd go out to dinner. And one of those times, he had just finished, or was about the point of finishing his second year, and he had been appointed to Panama.
Hmm.
And so we're in the car, and he's turns to John, my husband, and he says, well, wouldn't you like to come and work with me in Panama? And John looks at me, and I say, yes! And so, because I like adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And so we made that change. I left Williams' office. He was up for re-election, so I worked through the election. So that would have been November of 64. I had a baby by that time.
So I've always, four now.
I've always thought that because I went to work in the morning, finished off my correspondence, went to the hospital, had the baby. John came back to the office, reported everything was okay. Then later, years later, Senator Williams was the sponsor of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which became necessary because of a Supreme Court decision that something to the effect that pregnancy discrimination wasn't really sex discrimination, which, yes, many eye rolls, and cartoons. There was a cartoon of Justice Rehnquist with his robe covering his big pregnancy.
Oh, boy.
There was disrespect for this decision for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. but Congress responded with the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, so I always thought maybe I had a part in that. But
yeah.
So then we moved to Panama.
Right, with all four girls.
With
three girls and a boy?
Three girls and a boy. He was not quite one when we arrived in Panama in the spring of 65. But that was so interesting.
Uh-huh.
I give credit to the State Department. I hope they are still doing this, that they prepared us very well in language.
Mm-hmm.
They offered me, as what they referred to as an aid wife, you don't want to hear all I can tell about what it was like to be an aid wife. You were expected to do whatever the wife of your husband's superior thought you should do.
Wow.
I know.
That was your role.
That was our role.
Oh, wow.
But it was very interesting because I started little Nancy, the four-year-old, right away in a kinder.
Mm-hmm.
So that was not in the zone. It was a regular private kinder in Panama City, so she was able to meet other American girls, but mostly Panamanian children.
Mm-hmm.
And we were invited to their birthday parties, and there would be piñatas and food and sangria, not for the kids.
Obviously, no.
So that was a good way to meet people. And then we joined, as usual, the Lutheran Church, and we met a couple who were Lutheran missionaries, and the wife, Rhoda Mahler, was teaching in a Panamanian private high school, IPA, Instituto Panamericano, that was sponsored by the Methodist Church.
Oh.
And their primary goal was preparing English-speaking clerical employees for the Canal Zone.
Mm.
But they also had a college prep, and she wanted to go to the U.S. for the U.S. summer vacation, which for them is school, because their summer vacation is at a different time. So I took over her classes.
Mm.
That gave me a chance to teach Shakespeare and shorthand to Panamanian students, whose English was pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And did you teach in English or Spanish?
I taught in English.
In English, okay.
Right. And I was still taking Spanish classes.
Mm-hmm.
The embassy, the State Department provided wives with continuous Spanish education if they wanted to have it.
Cool.
Yeah.
And your husband's, what was your husband's position there?
He was assistant program officer.
To the State Department?
To the USAID.
Okay, got it.
And that involved a lot of travel around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to meet a lot of Peace Corps volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's how I met Jack Long.
Mm.
Because he...
He was in Panama, wasn't he?
He was.
Oh.
And the interesting thing is that the Peace Corps was very new in those
days. Oh, yeah. It started with Kennedy.
Right. And so this is 65. It's very new. In fact, some of our longest time friends, besides Jack, were Peace Corps volunteers in Panama
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Nice.
And one couple were federal prosecutors in South Dakota. We've always spent time together with them talking about how we were going to go to law school. The interesting thing was that the Peace Corps at that time sent everybody to do community development. No matter what your background, what your skills, what your experience, you went out and you did community development.
Mm-hmm.
And so what John discovered, my husband, was that there were Peace Corps volunteers with law degrees, and they were out building fences, making pig pens, and he said to his boss, Jim Magellis, wouldn't it be wonderful if these Peace Corps lawyers could help the Panamanian lawyers put together a legal services for the poor? And so there were meetings, Jack attended those, and so did Bob Barker, who now teaches constitutional law at Duquesne University.
Mm-hmm.
He was the urban volunteer. So he actually had probably the most to do with putting this together. But Bob, the one who's in Pittsburgh, goes back to Latin America frequently. He's the one that introduced me to the Inter-American Bar Association. But he told me very recently that he was in Panama and that the agency that the Peace Corps volunteers and Panamanian lawyers put together is still in existence. It's still functioning.
Wow.
I think that's really a threat.
That's awesome. Yeah. So in 65, when you're in Panama, how old are you at that point?
Well, I was born in 34, so in 64 I would have been 30, so I was
31?
In my early 30s.
Early 30s, and four kids?
And four.
Got it.
But we had one in Panama.
Oh, you did? So now you have five.
Now I have five, yes. Cool. He's 52, I think, something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah. I know.
It all blends together.
It all blends together. So anyway, we come back from Panama.
When?
Late 69.
Okay, so you're there for 4 years?
Right, and
okay.
The idea... In those days, I'm smiling because when we were in Colombia talking with the U.S. Embassy human rights officer, nowadays everybody has had, well, this is 5 years ago, probably maybe six, everybody had to go to Baghdad. But when we were leaving Panama, everybody had to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So that was John's next post. And we thought, oh, five kids? I don't think so. So
yeah, he got 69. That's the war.
Right, precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. And Jim Magellis had gone there.
Yeah.
He told us when he got back that somebody said, "Well, what was your worst day in Vietnam, Jim?" And he said, "Well, when my helicopter went down four times." But Jim just celebrated his 101st birthday.
He's still kicking. Wow.
I took photos at the celebration in Fond du Lac last weekend. Mm. Fantastic guy.
Yeah.
A war hero. See, I knew him as a USAID official.
Mm-hmm. The one that USAID?
He was the one who taught the president of Panama how to campaign, which I can see him doing this. But what I did not know at that time, because he never talked about it, he was a war hero. He was the most medals of anybody in the 81st, I don't know the numbers, airborne. That's what
during which war?
World War II.
Wow.
His book that he wrote after he retired from the Foreign Service is All the Way to Berlin.
Wow.
And it tells about his adventures.
I read that book.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I have an autographed copy.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was later made into a video. But anyway, so we're back, and I go to law school.
Yeah, 70.
Started in the fall of 70.
Got it.
Yeah, graduated in 73. And so here we are.
73, five kids in Madison.
And hard to get a job.
Yeah.
You know, and I was Coifin Law Review. So you would have thought the big firms would hold out. No,
you're a woman.
Yeah, in those days, that was not, and I think it was almost more the five kids than being a woman, because Margot Melly twisted some arms. She knew people. There were arms that she could twist.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a few interviews, but when they heard about the five kids, that was it. I mean, that was over. But in those days, I remember Walter Rauschenbusch, a professor that I respected, talking about how when the Jewish lawyers couldn't get a job anywhere and they went to the government, and how what a great job they did with FDR and the New Deal and all that stuff. And he said, "Now we're going to have to do that all over again." And that
was it. So how many women were in your class, your graduating class?
Roughly 10%.
10%.
Yeah.
So it's still pretty small.
It's still pretty small. We had a women's group. We like our support group.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one woman teacher. Priscilla McDougall from the AG's office put together a women's law class.
Okay.
So that was about it, though. We had to look to the government. And so I'm grateful to that. I loved working for the city. I didn't realize how interesting it would be, but it's like a medium-sized corporation, except that it also has enforcement, police, fire, so that's an additional legal. So there's a host of legal issues, and I worked. I don't know, I guess they must have thought, okay, here's our first woman, let's put her on discrimination.
Hmm. So your first job was with what?
The city.
City of Madison?
Yeah, okay. I spent about 6 months at Revenue.
The Wisconsin Department of Revenue?
Right, okay. But as soon as the city HR person called me twice, called and said, are you going to apply? And I said, yeah. And a week post guy, I don't do anything. And I get another call saying, are you going to apply? And I did.
Yeah. So this is a city attorney for the city of Madison.
Right. There were, how many were there? 10-ish, maybe? I'm not sure. They ended up more like 15 lawyers, I think. But so.
And you're the first woman.
I believe, yes. Now, back in the 20s, there was a highly distinguished woman, Beatrice Lampert. She spent some time in the city attorney's office. I think she also had to do her own typing. That seemed, Sandra Day O'Connor had that experience, I think, when she first got out of law school and got a job. She had to do her own typing. But I had another achievement. My first day, I signed my wage insurance and all my other papers. I work 4 days. I'm in a terrible car crash, receive life-threatening injuries, collect wage insurance for about 6 months before I was able to go back to work.
Oh, no. So this is in 75? When was your accident?
74. February of 74. Wow. Yeah. So I went back to work probably in July.
Wow.
I know. It was very... it was interesting. They treat trauma in ways that are different today, but I have no complaint. I think the way I was treated was the most successful.
Mm-hmm.
I was in traction for 6 weeks, at home in cast for 6 weeks, back to the hospital, a very brief physical therapy, very brief. Told me I should go walking and go swimming, which I did do. And you know, I have never been back to doctor my knees.
Wow.
Even though they're badly damaged. They don't have rods that have to be taken out.
Mm-hmm.
They function as best they can. And so I thought that was great good fortune.
Wow, nice. So can you tell me a little bit more about your experience at the city attorney's office?
I had the great good fortune of working for an administration that sincerely wanted to comply with law.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best gift a lawyer can have, is to have a client that wants to comply.
Yeah, yeah.
So you spend your time researching, teaching, training, and giving them ways that they can do things that will keep them out of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, you don't count your wins because they don't sue you because you've done right.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate that I was working in an administration that wanted to do right. So Madison had never had a hiring order.
Mm-hmm.
In those days there had been so much discrimination in police and fire in particular, and some other areas as well, that the court would order every other hire has to be a minority or something like that, some numerical thing. We never had that because we were always able to demonstrate that we were doing our best, and you do that by actually doing it, by actually bringing in the minority workers and training them and making sure that they succeed, which of course always doesn't always happen.
No.
So you will be, we did a lot of teaching and training because we found that people mostly wanted success.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably the biggest gift you can have as a lawyer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my mom's a lawyer and my grandma's a lawyer. A lot of your stories are sounding a lot like my grandma. I think she graduated law school in 73.
Oh my
God. But she worked through the 60s and... just interesting, she tells stories and I'm like, how did you ever do that?
I know.
Just like as a woman in that profession in the 70s, it's just...
I know. There were strange things, but anyway.
Yeah.
So after I retired...
What year did you retire?
January 2002.
Okay.
But I'll tell you something that happened while I was still working.
Okay.
I'm sitting peacefully in my office, pick up the phone. It's the mayor's secretary. And she says, "Oh, you speak a little Spanish, don't you?" And I say, "Well, yeah." And she says, "Oh," she said, "help us out, because there's two representatives here from Apartado, from the Dane County sister community, and they were supposed to meet with the mayor, but the schedule is fouled up or something. We don't have anybody. Will you talk to them?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, sure, send them over." And she says, "Well, one of them is the mayor of Apartado."
Wow.
And I think, okay, they're going to come. We're going to talk about schools and sewers and streets and hospitals, whatever, municipal stuff. And they come, and it's Gloria Cortes, who was the mayor of Apartado at that time, and Father Francisco Leroux, who was later the head of the Jesuits in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's the head of the Truth Commission, which has just been appointed maybe 6 months ago or so. So we have met with him in Colombia a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I was wrong about what they were coming to tell about. They were telling about the desperate situation of the people of our sister community,
mm-hmm.
By the paramilitaries and
right.
the combination of the paramilitaries and the army.
Right. So no, not education. They're worried about the safety
sewers,
of the people.
No, exactly. And Gloria, I almost fell off my chair. She said she's the mayor and she's out visiting a school. They're singing the national anthem and the kids are all lined up, and all of a sudden these heavily armed paramilitaries come marching up, and one of them takes out a machete and slashes off the head of one of the kids. And I say, "What?" But later that has been confirmed. That happened. She didn't make up that story.
Wow.
That happened.
Wow.
And another time she went to her office early in the morning and she finds three dead bodies of her staff members waiting for her as she is going to enter the office.
So when was this meeting? The 90s?
Would have been 90s.
Yeah, okay.
Right, would have been 90s. So I didn't know what to make of that. I can't remember if I talked to Jack at that time. I really didn't get much connection with Columbia until I retired, and Jack invited me to be on the board
okay.
of the Columbia.
So what year did you retire?
January 02.
So you worked at the city attorney's office
from
74 to 02?
Right. I became city attorney in 91.
So you were the city attorney?
Right, from that,
okay.
from that period.
For a little over 10 years?
Right.
Okay.
And so I was able to hire some really good people, some of whom are still there, I'm happy to say.
Yeah. Good. That's awesome. And did you, I read somewhere that you, as city attorney, hired a lot of women.
Actually, I was fortunate to be able to do that.
Yeah.
As I said, most of them are still there. Some are even retired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so can you tell me a little bit more about how you got involved with Columbia Support Network?
Well, that was how. Now, I had, when we settled my lawsuit, because my crash in 74 was caused by a drunk driver who was fortunately had good insurance.
Okay.
And so we didn't have to litigate liability.
Mm-hmm.
We just litigated damages. And so I received enough money to take the trip to South America that I always had wanted to take, because the Peace Corps volunteers in Panama used to come and tell us about how they went to Machu Picchu and here and there, and we couldn't afford to do that.
Right.
But so we thought, well, that's something we're going to do. So the first stop on this trip was Bogota, because that's where Jim Magellis was posted at that time. He was head of the Columbia, you say.
Okay.
So we stayed at their house. But we did meet Jack, because Jack was in Colombia, I think, teaching at the University de los Andes, I think, at that time. And he introduced us to Cecilia.
And what year was this?
It would have been 76.
76, okay.
Right. And so that's how we met Cecilia.
Mm-hmm.
We had, and Jim was having a party. It was a season when they changed, so there were a lot of despedida parties, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my favorite story of one of those parties. We meet a couple of USA people, and one of them says, "Oh, you're from Madison. Isn't that the place where they have that hippie mayor?" I thought, this is so cool.
Wow.
But so we got a chance to meet Cecilia,
mm-hmm.
and then, Jack had a beautiful home in the shores of Elkhart Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And so while they were down there, our family would go up there mm-hmm. and stay a week in their beautiful place and enjoy Elkhart Lake.
Mm-hmm. And that's in what part of Wisconsin? Is it north of here?
It's northeast.
Northeast,
it's towards Sheboygan.
Okay.
Near Plymouth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't think they have that house anymore.
Well, I don't think so either. I think they sold
but
that.
But it was a lovely place to be.
Nice. And so you ended with five kids.
Right.
Right?
Okay. That's it.
All right.
For the five kids, yes. Five kids. And I am so fortunate. They all live in Dane County.
They do? All five?
All five.
Wow.
And so, yeah, because now one of them lived in Spain for 20 years, but she came back.
Okay.
And the other one married a naval person, and so they were all over. We visited them in Italy, but they came back. So everybody's here, and that's
awesome. That's really, really nice.
So then when I started to take an interest in Colombia, we went the first delegation, 04.
Okay.
That was when the peace community had been formed,
mm-hmm.
and they were still living in the village of San Jose de Apartadón.
Mm-hmm.
The municipalities are a little bit different from what we're used to.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of calling it a village, they call it the urban part, because the county is, and it's interesting because they don't have the kind of residential voting that we are. Mm-hmm. That's important to us. In other words, it's important that you live in the district where you're voting.
Right.
But they had, like, the city council of Apartadón, which is really a county.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody out in the country was represented on that county and mm-hmm. that board.
Mm-hmm.
So the campesinos are essentially without representation.
Mm-hmm.
That
and can you just explain for people who don't know what campesinos are?
The farmers. Some people translate that as peasant,
mm-hmm.
but that has a kind of a pejorative meaning, mm-hmm. so I usually don't translate it at all. I usually just translate campesino, hoping that people...
Right.
What they are is they work farms. They're subsistence farmers mm-hmm. almost always. Mm-hmm. They do raise some things that can be sold, like the cacao.
Mm-hmm.
And some vegetables, depending on the kind of transportation that they have. They then, when the terrible massacre took place, February 21st, 2005, I'll never forget when Cecilia called me and she sent me an email, and it showed Luisa Guadalguera, the one who was the leader who was murdered along with his partner and his 12-year-old son.
Yep.
And then another part,
mm-hmm.
another family group was murdered, including two babies. It was just awful. It later came out in some prosecutions that the soldier that was along with the paramilitary who was killing the babies said, "Well, they'll grow up to be guerrillas." There's the paramilitary mindset for you.
Yeah.
It's that everybody that lives up in the hills is probably helping the guerrillas, so let's kill them.
Wow.
And that's pretty much the way it went.
Oh, boy. That's just... It's hard for us in the U.S. to wrap our minds around that, you know.
Right, it is. It is. And that danger is still there.
Mm-hmm.
The peace community is in great danger today. I just yesterday got a new message from their website that I've got it half translated.
Even with the peace process, it's not...
Peace, that's right. It's very difficult for certain segments of the Army and for certain segments of the business community to get used to the idea, to get away from the idea of the internal enemy,
mm-hmm.
the idea that there are people among us who are our enemies. That's something that they've lived with for 50 years, and they're really used to it.
Yeah.
And they, in some ways, they miss the guerrillas, because you can blame the guerrillas for everything that goes wrong. It's their fault. Well, they're gone. I mean, it's not that they don't still exist, but they
get... Like the FARC?
Right.
Right.
They turned over their weapons, and so there's a few dissidents out there, but there's really no guerrillas to blame for things.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's very difficult. That's like turning a battleship, and Columbia's not succeeding in doing that. Let's hope they can eventually do it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I don't know. I also read that you had... that you did legal work for Montenegro and Kazakhstan, is that right?
I had the opportunity, just as I was retiring, a connection with the International Municipal Lawyers Association.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, that group has a group that's really been important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I've always gone to their conferences and given a presentation on some municipal issue. But they have like a sister organization. The relationship is largely just of people.
Mm-hmm.
The same founder, Charles Ryan, founded the International Municipal Lawyers Association and founded the World Jurist Association.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of these connections that offered me the opportunity to review a proposed municipal local government regulations. And I did that. And I actually got paid for it. That's the only pay that I've ever received for post-retirement work. But it was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something... But I did stay with the World Jurist Association.
Okay.
And we were able... Because there's... The municipal attorneys like to give a local government twist to the World Jurist Association
mm-hmm.
presentations. And so to do that, we went to Australia,
mm-hmm.
where I gave a presentation on volunteerism.
Okay.
It was the United Nations International Year of the Volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting.
What year was that?
I'm not going to remember
okay.
the years. That was one of the first ones. Then we went to China and... I gave a presentation on code enforcement.
Oh.
I suspect it was lost on the Chinese audience, because in the week that we were in China, we'd be split between Beijing and Shanghai, there were, I believe, 2 industrial accidents with fatalities. So the whole notion of code enforcement, I'm not sure how that's going
mm-hmm.
even in China today, but the research that I did, the fire department helped me with the website of the International Fire Protection
mm-hmm.
Association.
Mm-hmm.
The major disasters, a fire in Paraguay that took more than 400 lives, and 2 very similar, one in Rhode Island and one in Buenos Aires, both rock bands with pyrotechnics and dangerous substances and locked doors. That doesn't seem to go away. A building that collapsed in Jerusalem, causing the code enforcement people to complain that the city council members always overrule their code orders. So stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
If I've gotten a lot out of going to the World Jurist meetings and the Inter-American Bar meetings. Buenos Aires, Mexico City, El Salvador. I went to Panama last year because I want to go to Panama again. And I'm planning to go to the Dominican Republic in June
for
the Inter-American Bar.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So that's all the questions that I have. Do you have anything else you want to say for the record about undergrad or law school or abroad or anything like that?
Well,
maybe a little bit about how Madison's transformed since you got here in 51 to 2018. I feel like it's probably more populated.
Oh, undoubtedly. And it has immigrants. It has Latinos, mm-hmm. Which if it did in the 50s when I arrived, I didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. My daughter teaches bilingual kindergarten at Nuestro Mundo. Mm. I tutor in the jail, Spanish speakers, and I did a literacy network tutor of an immigrant. So I try to connect with people that speak Spanish to improve my own Spanish and also to get their perspective, the mm-hmm. things that mm-hmm. they know. Mm-hmm.
Sí, pero su español es muy bien, sí.
Es que no se oye muy bien. No. Es que tengo que trabajar en oír.
Sí, mm-hmm. sí.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. All right.
Well, thank you so much, Emma.
Thanks for coming and being available. I really appreciate it.
I hope.
Yeah, so I'll just pause it.